Chapter 17, Jerusalem, Friday, April 7th, AD 30, early morning, day. The assault comes out of nowhere, a hard punch to the head, delivered by a short-fused temple guard. Is this the way you answer the high priest? Jesus staggers, unable to answer. The opulent palace room reels. His hands are still bound, and he can neither protect himself nor fight back. But even as a Nazarene absorbs the blow, he speaks without fear. If I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong, he finally tells the guard. But if I spoke the truth, why do you strike me? A bleary-eyed Annas stands before Jesus. It is closer to dawn than to midnight. The high priest is in his mid-50s, a man whose entire life has revolved around procuring wealth and power. Normally, men such as Jesus bow to him, pleading for mercy rather than trying to bend his mind with logic at this awful hour. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus said just moments ago. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Those were the fearless and articulate words that spurred the guard to strike Jesus. They now echo in Annas' skull as he tries to figure out his next move. The patriarch is a Zadokite, descended from a line of priests dating back to King David. Like his sons and son-in-law Caiaphas, he's also a Sadducee, a member of a wealthy Jewish sect that believes only in the Pentateuch, as the five books of Moses are known. Annas has made many compromises with Rome in order to maneuver his way into power. The job of high priest was passed down through the Zadokite lineage for centuries, but Alexander the Great's conquest of the Jewish homeland 3 centuries ago led to an attempt to Hellenize the region. This is why Annas is fluent in Greek as well as Hebrew, for his family long ago learned the importance of pleasing its conquerors. A group of Jews known as the Hasmoneans put an end to overt Hellenization in 142 BC, but also stripped these Zadokites of the high priesthood. This became a blessing of sorts when the Romans conquered Jerusalem 80 years later. Non-Zadokite priests were singled out for massacre when Pompey and his troops looted the city after a 3-month siege. It was Herod the Great who finally restored the Zadokites to the high priesthood. But with that power came compromise, for Herod made sure that these new priests served at his favor, and that meant bowing down to Rome. No longer are the high priests autonomous. It is a lesson Annas learned when he was removed from his position by Pontius Pilate's predecessor, Gratus, for imposing and executing capital sentences, which had been forbidden by the imperial government. Making the same mistake twice or allowing Caiaphas to make that mistake could be catastrophic. As patriarch, Annas sees the future of the family dynasty might just rest on how he handles the Jesus situation. But the title of high priest is one a man carries for life. Rome likes it that way because it ensures that the money pipeline flows uninterrupted. Annas, his son Eleazar, his son-in-law Caiaphas, and his other sons Jonathan, Theopolis, Matthias, and Ananus will all take turns serving as high priest. They will control the sale of temple lambs at Passover and receive a cut of every exchange made by the money changers. Outside Jerusalem, the high priests own vast farms and estates. The profits from these ventures, in addition to the taxes extorted from the people of Judea, are all shared with Pilate and eventually with the debauched Roman Emperor Tiberius, who gets a substantial amount of money in the form of tribute. So it is that the lineage of Jesus and Annas have been intertwined for centuries and will be for decades to come. Annas' forefathers served as high priests under Jesus' forebearers, David and Solomon. And just as Annas now stands in judgment of Jesus, so the younger Ananus will sentence another devout man to death 3 decades from now. That man's name is James, a confidant of Jesus, and he will be publicly stoned to death. Indeed, so fierce is Annas and his descendants' loyalty to Rome that the final link in their chain to the priesthood will come to an end 30 years from now, when the younger Ananus is killed in a Jewish uprising for advocating a continuation of Roman rule. Everything about Jesus' interrogation is illegal. It takes place at night. Jesus is asked to incriminate himself without a lawyer, and Annas has no authority to pass sentence. It is also highly unusual for a prisoner to be brought to the high priest's personal residence, rather than to prison cells at the Roman barracks. But Jesus has committed a grave offense. he interrupted the flow of funds from the Temple of Rome when he flipped over the money changers' tables. The pipeline is a personal responsibility of Annas. Anyone interfering with the profit-taking must be punished. That, of course, includes Jesus and every single one of his disciples. Annas is determined that this will be a cautionary tale for anyone who considers challenging the authority of the temple courts. A man like Annas is used to people bowing and scraping in his presence, but it is clear that Jesus will not genuflect to any man. And despite Jesus' weakened condition, he is still capable of great feats of intellect. Perhaps some time alone with the temple guards will change that attitude. As a former high priest, Annas has no jurisdictional powers. He cannot pass sentence, particularly in matters concerning sedition or insurrection, for that power belongs solely to Rome. Thus, Annas secretly orders a gang of temple guards to escort Jesus to a quiet place on the palace grounds where they might spend some time together. Footnote: the guards on duty that night were the Levites who served as the temple's police force. Under normal circumstances, they served as gatekeepers to the temple entrances, patrolled the temple grounds day and night, and stood watch at one of the 21 posts in the court of the Gentiles. But this night, they did something else. Jesus, still bound, is led away. An urgent call goes out through Jerusalem. The high religious court of the Sanhedrin must assemble immediately. Jesus cannot see. The night is dark, and the blindfold covering his eyes shuts out even the minimal light of the small fires. But he can hear extremely well, and the words directed at him are clearly meant to break his spirit. "Prophecy," a temple guard calls out scornfully. Jesus is staggered by another hard punch. "Who hit you?" the guard mocks. Fists and kicks come from all sides. There is no escape and no respite. "Who hit you?" the guards call out again and again, landing more blows. "Who hit you?" The beating goes on for hours, until the temple guards become too tired to continue their savage game. By the time Jesus is led back into Annas' home to confront the Sanhedrin in yet another illegal trial, he is bloodied and bruised, his face swollen. Exhaustion and weakness caused by a loss of plasma make it difficult for him to even stand, let alone form a coherent argument that might save him. Yet once again, the bound and beaten Jesus must rise before his accusers and argue for his life. Jesus appears before the Sanhedrin, no longer blindfolded. It is impossible to tell whether all 71 members of the religious court are crowded into the room, but he has not been taken to the temple courts as law requires. Instead, the clerics surround him in the residential warmth of Annas' palace home, where Jesus can clearly see the mosaic floors and the fashionable paintings hanging from the walls. Bruises now cover Jesus' body and face. He has not eaten since the Last Supper. Yet the beating and the mocking have not broken his spirit. Despite the late hour, news of Jesus' arrest has made its way around Jerusalem. A small crowd now gathers in the courtyard, warming themselves by the fire pits. A second group stands outside the palace's gates, waiting for any news. Two of the disciples have had second thoughts about abandoning Jesus and have braved the arrest to be here. They stand among a number of men loyal to Caiaphas. Footnote: Peter is mentioned by name in John 18:15. The passage references another disciple, though not by name. Based on his vivid description of that night's events, it is widely believed that John was this individual. Jesus watches as, one by one, Caiaphas' sycophants come in out of the cold to falsely testify against him. They stand before the Sanhedrin and brazenly lie about Jesus, spinning stories about things he has said and done. The members of the Sanhedrin listen closely, waiting for the one accusation that might allow them to pass the death sentence. They tolerate the litany of lies, trusting that an accusation worthy of a death sentence will eventually be revealed in these proceedings, even if it takes all night. Technically, bearing false witness is a crime punishable by death, but the Sanhedrin is willing to conveniently sidestep that legality for tonight. Throughout the process, Jesus says nothing. Then comes the accusation for which the Sanhedrin is waiting. "This fellow," swear two men loyal to Caiaphas, "said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Caiaphas has been sitting, but now suddenly rises and advances toward Jesus. To Caiaphas' utter fury, Jesus does not contest the allegation. One look at the Nazarene, and it's clear that his will should have been broken long ago. the dried blood, the residue of spittle, the hematomas, and the swelling. Yet Jesus is placid and ever defiant. "Are you not going to answer?" Caiaphas demands with indignation. "What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" Jesus remains silent. He can see the question forming on Caiaphas's lips. It is the query to which everyone in the room wants an answer. Indeed, it is the one question that hundreds of thousands here in Jerusalem also want answered. But even as Jesus anticipates what Caiaphas is about to ask next, he also realizes that there is no proper response. His death is imminent, no matter what he says. "I charge you under oath," fumes Caiaphas, "by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Silence. Outside, the first birds of morning are stirring. Conversations can be heard from beyond the courtroom. But in this public room where Caiaphas usually socializes and privately conducts official temple business, no one utters so much as a syllable as they anxiously await Jesus' decision. Will he finally speak? Jesus does answer. "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." "Are you the Son of God?" the priests demand. "Yes," he tells them, "it is as you say." Then Jesus looks straight at Caiaphas. "You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Caiaphas grabs the front of his own tunic and wrenches the expensive fabric, tearing it down from his chest. Under normal circumstances, high priests are forbidden to display anger in such a manner. But these are not normal circumstances, for Jesus is implying nothing less than that Caiaphas is an enemy of God. "He has spoken blasphemy," the high priest tells the Sanhedrin. "Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" Religious law says that each member of the Sanhedrin must cast a vote when passing sentence. But now, there is no vote. The verdict is passed by simple consensus. The only voices of dissent come from Nicodemus and a wealthy Sadducee named Joseph of Arimathea. The sun is rising. Jesus has been convicted of blasphemy and sentenced to death. The next step is as easy or as difficult as convincing Pontius Pilate to order his Roman executioners to do the deed. Across Jerusalem, in the Antonia Fortress, the dozen men who comprise a Roman death squad sit down to their breakfast, the big meal of the day. They will most likely not be able to get back to the barracks for the light midday lunch, so they enjoy their large portion of porridge. It is often served with cheese and honey to make it ever more filling and to provide more energy for the hard labor to come. Bread, weak beer, and red wine are spread out on the long communal table. Barabbas and his cohorts, already condemned to death, are being held not far away in the fortress's stone dungeons. In time, they will be taken into the courtyard for scourging by the Romans. Low scourging posts are permanently positioned there for the task. Affixed to the top of each post is a metal ring. Each condemned man will be brought forth with his hands tied. The executioners will strip him of his clothing and then force him to his knees before binding his wrists over his head to the metal ring. The wrists will then also be shackled to the ring. This locks the body in position, preventing any squirming or other attempts to dodge the blows of the whip. Even before the first lash is laid against a man's back, it is common for the victim to tense every muscle in his body and grit his teeth against the horrible pain that will soon be inflicted. The key to the executioner's art is not how hard they whip a man, but the effort with which they yank the whip's metal and bone-flecked tendrils away from the flesh after each blow. For this is when the primary damage to the body is done. To prove themselves superior, the professional killers, now casually eating their morning meal, strive to grip the wooden handle of the whip a little harder than their peers and lean into the lash with just a bit more strength. If they do their jobs exceptionally well, they might expose the victim's internal organs. As the historian Eusebius will write of the spectacle, bystanders are struck with amazement when they saw them lacerated with scourges even to the innermost veins and arteries, so that the hidden inward parts of the body, both their bowels and their members, were exposed to view. Yet as horrific as the process of lashing might be, it is just the start of the agony, for the whip is a mere prelude to crucifixion. The soldiers finish their porridge and push back from the table. Time to go to work. The condemned Jesus is marched to the palace of Pontius Pilate. The sound of his sandals and those of the high priests and temple guards who surround him on all sides echo off the cobblestones. It is not yet 7 a.m., and Jerusalem is just waking up. The path takes Jesus past the small barracks where a garrison of palace soldiers grimly watch the procession. And then the path winds past the lavish formal gardens Herod the Great constructed so long ago, with ponds, groves of trees, and quiet walkways from which doves can be seen alongside small streams. Palace walls form the northern boundary of the garden, and now Jesus has marched along those walls to the front gate, where soldiers take their four-hour guard shift. Caiaphas demands an immediate audience with Pilate. He stands outside the gates with Jesus, the temple guard, and the entire Sanhedrin. But since the high priest cannot enter a Gentile residence so close to Passover, or risk becoming unclean and unable to eat the sacred meal, he requests that Pilate come down to the gate. It is a gross violation of their formal relationship, but surely Pilate will understand. The palace is enormous, a fortified square measuring 140 meters from south to north. It consists of two lavish wings, one named the Caesareum and the other the Agrippium. Towers rise at intervals along its walls, and column courtyards provide open space. At the south end, just on the other side of the palace walls, is a special courtyard known as the Praetorium, where pronouncements, trials, and other public gatherings can take place. So it takes a while to get word to Pilate, and for the prefect to dress and make his way down to the gate. He could not have been pleased to be faced with the sight of temple guards, lavishly dressed priests, and a prisoner who was clearly in an advanced state of physical suffering. "What charges are you bringing against this man?" Pilate asked gruffly. Caiaphas has been dreading this moment. For, while he wants the Romans to kill Jesus, the charge of blasphemy is a Jewish offense. Rome could not care less about it. And Pilate, with his intolerance for the Jews, is not the sort to risk his career by allowing Jewish law to dictate whom he executes. "If he were not a criminal, would we have handed him over to you?" Caiaphas replies, avoiding the question. Pilate is not easily swayed. "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," Caiaphas responds. "I find no basis for a charge against this man," Pilate replies. Another of the priests speaks up. "He stirs up people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." "He's a Galilean?" Pilate demands. In this simple question, he sees a way out of the mess. The Sanhedrin is clearly luring him into a political trap. But if Jesus is a Galilean, the matter is better suited for Herod Antipas. Galilee is the Tetrarch's jurisdiction, and Antipas is staying in a palace just a few blocks away. Pilate refuses to accept custody of Jesus. He dismisses the entire gathering and orders Jesus to be bound over to Antipas. Once again, Jesus is marched through the early dawn streets of Upper Jerusalem. There is no sign of the peasant pilgrims from Galilee or of any other poorer class of Jews, for they have no reason to be wandering through this wealthy neighborhood at such an early hour. Slaves can be seen sweeping the porches of their masters' homes, while inside the wealthy take their morning meal. But if Pilate thinks he has escaped from Caiaphas' snare, he is wrong. For soon the entire temple group, including Jesus, returns. Herod Antipas was most delighted to finally meet the Nazarene and spent a short time taking the measure of him. The Tetrarch even requested a miracle for his personal amusement. Antipas has no fear of Caiaphas or the high priest, for they have no power over him. So even as they launch volley after volley of accusation against Jesus, hoping to swing the Tetrarch over to their side, Antipas refused to listen. Getting pulled into a power struggle between the temple and Rome is most unwise. Besides, he's still haunted by the death of John the Baptist and the predictions by many that it will bring down his kingdom. The last thing Antipas needs is the blood of another holy man on his hands. Even though Jesus refused to perform a miracle, Antipas saw no reason to condemn him to death. He let his soldiers have their fun, allowing them to taunt the Nazarene and ridicule him by questioning his royalty before placing an old military mantle on a prisoner's shoulders. It was purple, the color of kings. Now, once again, Pilate stands at his palace gates debating what to do about Jesus. He has underestimated Antipas, forgetting that the Tetrarch was raised in a household where treachery and guile were as routine as breathing. Strangely, Pilate sees Antipas's decision as a quiet show of solidarity with him, for Antipas, a Jew, has clearly chosen to back Rome instead of the temple priests. Pilate and Antipas were enemies until now, but they will count each other as friends from this day forward. But Pilate must still deal with the wily Caiaphas, who has been coached in palace intrigue by Annas and again stands before him. Pilate is running out of options. Clearly, he cannot order the Jews to release Jesus, for that would be interfering in their religious law. And the Emperor Tiberius has made it quite clear that the Roman governors cannot do this. Still, he doesn't have to accept the prisoner. He could order that Caiaphas send Jesus over to the Antonia fortress, there to be held until after Passover, perhaps long after Passover, when Pilate has already left town. Above all, Pontius Pilate does not want trouble. So he finally sends Caiaphas on his way and reluctantly accepts custody of the Nazarene. The fate of Jesus is now in the hands of Rome. Pontius Pilate is curious. "Are you the king of the Jews?" he asks Jesus. The governor is seated on a throne of judgment, looking down upon an open-air courtyard paved with flagstones. A small audience watches. Pilate has chosen this location for many reasons. It is far removed from the center of the palace, near where his small personal garrison is housed. The courtyard is not actually in the palace, but adjacent to it. Its unique architecture allows Pilate to address his subjects from an elevated position, while also providing him a private entrance where he can come and go, and where prisoners such as Jesus can be let out and tried, and then quietly walk back to the prison cells. Another advantage to the location at the outer edge of the palace grounds is that it's not actually inside the residence, and so Jews are permitted to enter on the eve of Passover. Hence the presence of temple priests and Caiaphas' disciples, who are carefully monitoring the proceedings for their leader. They are there to ensure that the sentence passed by Caiaphas and the Pharisees is carried out. "Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me?" Jesus asks Pilate. "Am I a Jew?" Pilate asks. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrests. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," says an amused Pilate. This is good news for the governor, for by declaring himself to be sovereign, Jesus has now committed a crime against Rome and the emperor. He is now a serious threat to public order. Whatever happens next can now be justified. "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I am born, and for this reason I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me," Jesus responds. "What is the truth?" Pilate asks, now fascinated by Jesus. But if the Roman was expecting an answer to that question, he is disappointed, as Jesus stands mute. Pilate knows that preaching is not a crime, unless rebellion against Rome is a theme of that preaching. But any dissension from the powerful Sanhedrin will not help Pilate with Tiberius. So he turns his attention from Jesus to the disciples of the Jewish temple, who now fill the courtyard. From his lofty perch, he can look down upon the group measuring their reaction. It is customary for the Roman prefect to release a prisoner at the time of Passover. Now Pilate finds a simple solution to ease out of this politically volatile situation. He will give the crowd a choice between releasing the peaceful Jesus or the horrific Barabbas, a terrorist and murderer whose crimes truly deserve punishment. "Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" Pilate asks the crowd. The response surprises him, for Pilate is not aware that the people he is speaking to have been ordered by the high priests and religious elders to make sure that Jesus is executed. It's not the Jewish pilgrims who want Jesus dead, nor most of the residents of Jerusalem. No, it is a small handful of men who enrich themselves through the temple. To them, a man who speaks the truth is far more dangerous than a mass murderer. "Give us Barabbas," they shout back. At the same time that Jesus is being judged, the business of Passover begins in the temple courts. Despite their sleepless night, Caiaphas and the other priests cannot afford the luxury of a morning's rest. Soon, they walk across a bridge connecting the upper city with the temple and prepare to go about their day. Already, long lines of pilgrims are forming, and with them grows the incessant bleeding of young male lambs. The first sacrifices will take place at noon, in keeping with the law. Rows of priests are now assembling, some carrying silver bowls and others gold. These are for catching the blood of the lamb as its throat is slit. The bowls are then carried to the altar and the blood poured in sacrifice. A Levite choir is gathering as well, along with men who will honor this great day with blasts from their silver trumpets. Pontius Pilate does not care a whit about what is happening inside the temple. The focus of his attention is a problem still standing before him. The Roman governor does not believe that executing such a popular figure as Jesus is a wise decision. Any unrest among the people following an execution of this sort would certainly be reported to Tiberius, and any fallout laid at the feet of Pilate. So rather than crucify Jesus, Pilate sentences the Nazarene to a brutal whipping. Perhaps that will appease the Sanhedrin. The Roman governor calls the high priests and church elders together to announce this decision. "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and found no basis for your charges against him. Neither is Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." Within moments, the Nazarene is stripped and led into the praetorium courtyard. The scourging pole awaits. Chapter 18, Jerusalem's Upper City, April 7th, A.D. 30, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Jesus endures. As with any other victim, his hands are manacled to the metal ring atop the scourging post, rendering him unable to move. Two legionnaires stand behind him, one on either side. Each grabs a wooden-handled whip, from which extend three leather tendrils. Each thong is roughly 3 feet long. Today, rather than bits of metal or sheep bone, the executioners have affixed to the tips small lead weights known as plummeti. The choice is strategic. These dumbbell-shaped implements do not rip away the flesh and muscle so quickly as the sharper scorpionis tips. It is not yet time for Jesus to die. A third legionnaire stands to one side. He holds an abacus so that he might keep track of the number of blows inflicted. The fourth member of the squad is a man responsible for tying and chaining Jesus to the scourging post. He now stands by to replace any member of the death squad who tires in his duties. Watching over all of this is the exactor mortis, the supervisor. Jesus feels the lash. There is no gap between the blows. The instant one executioner pulls back his whip, the other unfurls the lash across Jesus' back. Even when the tendrils of leather and lead get tangled, the soldiers don't stop. The most lashes a man can receive under the laws of Moses are 40 minus 1. But the Romans don't always trifle with Jewish legalities. Pilate has told these men to lash Jesus, and now they do so until the Nazarene is physically broken, but not yet dead. That is the order. Scourge the Nazarene, but under no circumstances is he to be killed. After the whipping, Jesus is unchained and helped to his feet. He has cried out in pain during his scourging, but he has not vomited or had a seizure as many do. Still, he is losing a lot of blood due to his severely lacerated back. The lash marks extend down to the back of his calves, and in addition to the dehydration that has plagued him all night, Jesus is in the early stages of shock. The Roman death squad has clearly done its job. Striking at the Nazarene with surgical precision, they have beaten him almost to death. Pilate has made it clear that this will be the extent of their duties today. Yet they stand by for more, just in case. Jesus' hands are still tied in front of him. He's slowly led back to the prison where the Roman soldiers have their own brand of fun with this unique prisoner. Jesus says nothing as they drape that filthy purple cloak over his naked body, knowing it will soon stick to his wounds. The soldiers then make a faux scepter from a reed and thrust it into the hands of Jesus, again mocking his claim of being a king. Rather than take pity on a man who has just endured a scourging, the soldiers spit on the Nazarene. If the Romans stopped there, it would be a moment of low comedy by a group of barbaric men. But these brutes now turn their mockery into sadism. Up to this point, it can be argued, they are merely soldiers doing the job they were trained to do. Certainly the Nazi death squads of World War II, who will pattern much of their behavior after the cold, heartless actions of the Roman Quaternio, use that defense. The actions of Julius Caesar and so many other Roman warriors clearly show that unthinkably harsh punishment was a standard way to deal with enemies of Rome. There was even a certain pathological creativity to their methods. But now the soldiers guarding Jesus up the ante. This is not a single death squad, but an entire company of Pilate's hand-picked legionnaires. In an atrocious display, They begin to cut a tall white shrub. Ramanus nabica features rigid elliptical leaves and small green flowers, but its most dominant characteristic is the inch-long curving thorns that sprout closely together. The soldiers are more than willing to endure the prick of these sharp spikes as they weave several branches together to form a crown. When they are done, this wreath makes a perfect complement to the reed and the purple cloak. All hail the king. Jesus is too weak to protest when the crown of thorns is fitted onto his head and the spikes pressed hard into his skin. They brush up against the many nerves surrounding the skull almost immediately and then crash into the bone. Blood pours down from his face. Jesus stands humiliated in a small prison as soldiers dance around him, some punching him, others spitting, and still others getting down on both knees to praise their king. Piling on, the soldiers rip the reed from Jesus' hand and strike him hard across the head, which pushes the thorns even deeper into that tight network of nerves. The result is an instant fiery sensation radiating up and down his face. Much to the jailer's delight, they have contrived one of the most gruesome methods of torture conceivable. But just when it seems that Jesus can't take any more, the soldiers receive word that Pilate would like to see the prisoner. Once again, Jesus is led out into the public square where the Sanhedrin and its loyal followers stand waiting. Jesus' vision has blurred. Fluid is slowly building around his lungs. He's having a hard time breathing. He has predicted his death all along, but the details of his demise are shocking. The high priest and religious leaders watch as Jesus steps forth, the crown of thorns still on his head. In him they see the memory of a man who publicly humiliated them in the temple just 3 days ago. They can see his suffering now, yet they have no sympathy whatsoever. Jesus must die. The more painfully, the better. It is 9 a.m. as Pilate again takes his seat on the judgment throne. He tries one last time to release Jesus. "Here is your king," he snarls at the assembly of religious leaders and their disciples. "These men should be in the temple courts, for the slaughter of the lambs is soon to begin." "Take him away," the religious leaders chant. "Take him away. Crucify him." Pilate is tired of arguing. The Roman governor is not known for his compassion and believes he has done all he can do. The fate of Jesus is simply not worth the effort. "Shall I crucify your king?" he asks, seeking a final confirmation. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priest replies. If taken at face value, those words are an act of heresy, for in saying them, the priest is rejecting his own Jewish God in favor of the God of the Roman pagans. Yet the followers of the Sanhedrin see no irony in the situation. "What crime has he committed?" Pilate yells back. "Crucify him," comes the response. Pilate orders that a small bowl of water be brought to Jesus. He dips his hands into the chalice and theatrically makes a show of a ritual cleansing. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he tells the religious leaders. "It is your responsibility." But in fact, the responsibility belongs to Pilate. Only the Roman governor possesses the right of the sword, or as it's known, the right to execute. So, it is Pilate that orders his executioners to take control of Jesus. As they lead the Nazarene away to be crucified, Pontius Pilate prepares for an early lunch. The purple cloak is ripped away, but the crown of thorns remains. The death squad places a plank of unfinished wood on Jesus' shoulders. It weighs between 50 and 70 pounds. It is just a little less than 6 feet long, and its splinters quickly find their way into the open wounds on the Nazarene's body. The humiliation at Pilate's palace now complete, the procession toward the place of execution begins. At the front of the line is the officer known as the exactor mortis. By tradition, this centurion holds up a sign written in Greek, Aramaic, and Latin. Normally, a man's crimes are listed on the sign, which will be nailed onto the cross above him. This way, any passerby will know why the man is being crucified. So if treason is the charge, then that is what the sign should state. But Pontius Pilate is changing tradition. In a last attempt to get the better of Caiaphas, the governor writes the inscription himself in charcoal. "Jesus, the Nazarene, King of the Jews." "Change it," Caiaphas demands before the crucifixion procession gets underway. "It stays exactly as it is," Pilate replies, his condescension apparent. So the sign leads the way as Jesus and his four executioners make the painfully slow journey to Golgotha, the hill used as a Roman execution ground. The trip is slightly less than half a mile, taking Jesus through the cobbled streets of Jerusalem's upper city, then out the Gennith Gate to the low hill on which a vertical pole awaits him. It is getting close to noon. A substantial crowd has gathered to watch despite a blazing sun overhead. As a former builder and carpenter, the Nazarene knows the proper way to carry a length of lumber, but now he lacks the strength to do so. The exactor mortis becomes concerned as Jesus repeatedly stumbles. Should Jesus die before reaching the place of execution, it is the exactor mortis who will be held responsible. So a pilgrim bystander, an African Jew named Simon of Cyrene, is enlisted to carry the crossbeam for Jesus. A footnote. Not much is known about Simon of Cyrene, other than he hailed from the city of Cyrene in Libya, and had traveled almost 1,000 miles from there to be in Jerusalem for Passover. The procession continues. Despite the assistance, the Nazarene is constantly on the verge of fainting. Each stumble drives the thorns on his head deeper into his skull. Jesus is so thirsty, he can barely speak. Meantime, just a few hundred yards away in the temple courts, the celebration of Passover is well underway, diverting the attention of many who revere Jesus and who might otherwise have rioted to intervene and save his life. The execution site, Golgotha, is not a large hill. It's a low rise within a very short distance from Jerusalem's city wall. In fact, anyone standing atop those walls will be able to view Jesus' crucifixion at eye level, and will be so close that they can hear every word he says if he speaks loudly enough. But Jesus hasn't spoken in hours. As the procession arrives atop Golgotha, the soldiers send Simon away and hurl the crossbeam onto the dirt and rough limestone. Jerusalem Rock, some call it. The death squad takes control here. They force Jesus to the ground, laying his torso atop the upper crossbeam. His hands are then stretched out, and two soldiers put all their weight on his extended arms as another approaches with a thick mallet and a 6-inch iron nail with a square shaft that tapers to a point. The soldier hammers the sharpened point into Jesus' flesh at precisely the spot where the radius and the ulna bones meet the carpals of the wrist. He jabs the nail hard into the skin to stabilize it before impact. Jesus cries out in pain as the iron pierces its mark. The Romans used the wrist location because the nail never hits the bone, instead passing all the way through to the wood with just a few sharp swings of the hammer. The wrist bones, meantime, surround the soft tissue, forming a barrier. So when the cross is hoisted upward and the victim's body weight suspends from that spike, the bones keep the thin layer of muscle from ripping, preventing the person from falling to the ground. The first wrist secure, the executioner moves on to the second. A crowd watches from the base of the hill. Among them are Jesus' devoted friend, Mary Magdalene, and his mother, Mary. She came to Jerusalem for Passover, not having any idea what would befall her son. Now she can do nothing but look upon him in anguish. After Jesus is nailed to the crossbeam, the executioners hoist him to his feet. A careful balancing act ensues, because the weight of the wood is now on Jesus' back, not his shoulders. In his weakened state, he could easily fall over. Soldiers hold up both ends of the crossbeam, while a third steadies Jesus as they back him toward the vertical beam that will complete the cross. This in-ground pole is close to 8 feet tall. In cases where the Romans want a victim to suffer for days before dying, a small seat juts out halfway up its length. But tomorrow is a Sabbath, and Jewish law says that a man must be taken off the cross before it begins. The Romans want Jesus to die quickly. Thus, there is no seat on Jesus' cross. Nor is there a footrest. Instead, when the moment comes that his feet are nailed into the wood, they must first be flexed at an extreme angle. One soldier grabs Jesus around the waist and lifts him up as the other two hoist their ends of the crossbeam. The fourth executioner stands atop the ladder that leans against the crossbeam into the small joint that has been carved into the top of the vertical piece. The weight of Jesus' body holds the beam inside the groove. And so it is that Jesus of Nazareth now hangs on the cross. Another moment of agony comes when Jesus' knees are bent slightly and his feet are lapped one over the other and nailed into place. The spike passes through the fine metatarsal bones on its way into the wood. But amazingly, none of the bones break, which is extremely unusual in a crucifixion. Finally, in the spot directly over Jesus' head, the sign carried by the exactor mortis is nailed into the cross. Their physical work done, the death squad begins mocking Jesus, throwing dice for his once fine tunic, and calling up to him, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." The Roman killers will remain on Golgotha until Jesus dies. They will drink their sour wine and even offer some to Jesus. If necessary, they will break his legs to hasten his demise. For death on the cross is a slow journey into suffocation. Each time a victim takes a breath, he must fight his own body weight and push his torso upward using his legs, thus allowing his lungs to expand. In time, the victim, exhausted, can breathe neither in nor out. 3 hours pass. The Passover celebration continues inside the temple courts, and the sounds of singing and of trumpets resound across the city to the execution site. Indeed, Jesus can see the Temple Mount quite clearly from his place on the cross. He knows that many are still waiting for him. The news of his execution has not traveled far, much to the delight of Pilate and Caiaphas, who still fear the possibility of Jesus' supporters starting a riot when they hear news of his murder. "I thirst," Jesus finally says, giving in to the dehydration that has consumed him for more than 12 hours. His voice is not more than a whisper. A soldier soaks a sponge in sour wine and reaches up to place it into the Nazarene's lips, knowing the liquid will sting. Jesus sucks in the tart fluid. Shortly afterward, he gazes on Jerusalem one last time before the inevitable happens. "It is finished," he whispers. Jesus bows his head. The crown of thorns hangs rigidly. He lapses into unconsciousness. His neck relaxes. His entire body rolls forward, pulling his neck and shoulders away from the cross. Only the nails in his hands hold him in place. The man who once preached the gospel so fearlessly, who walked far and wide to tell the world about a new faith, and whose message of love and hope reached thousands during his lifetime, and will one day reach billions more, stops breathing. Jesus of Nazareth is dead. He is 36 years old. Chapter 19, Jerusalem's Upper City, April 7th, AD 30, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. The race is on. The Roman death squad has had a hard day, but there is still more work to be done. It is their practice to leave a man on the cross for days after he dies, perhaps to allow his body to decompose or even be eaten by wild animals. But Jewish law dictates that a body cannot remain on a tree during the Sabbath, which begins at sundown today and continues throughout Saturday. So, the Romans must take Jesus down off the cross and throw his body into the communal grave reserved for criminals. The exactor mortis now verifies Jesus' death by thrusting a spear into his chest. The pleural and pericardial fluid that had built up around Jesus' heart and lungs for hours now pours out, mixed with a torrent of blood. Extracting the spear tip, the captain of the guard then orders his men to remove Jesus from the cross. It is a crucifixion in reverse, with the men using ladders and teamwork to bring Jesus down and the crossbeam back to the ground. Once again, Jesus is laid flat. But now the death squad works hard to remove the nails unbent. Iron is expensive, and the spikes are reused as much as possible. Most who witnessed Jesus' crucifixion from a distance have departed. Mary, his mother, and Mary Magdalene are among those who remain. But as the soldiers now go about the hard physical labor of uncrucifying a man, a Sadducee named Joseph of Arimathea steps forth. This wealthy member of the Sanhedrin and secret disciple of Jesus was one of the few dissenting voices during the illegal trial. Another of those voices was that of Nicodemus the Pharisee, who now stands atop Golgotha with Joseph. They have received permission from Pilate to take the body, as the governor wants to put this execution to rest as soon as possible. Somewhat shockingly, Joseph and Nicodemus are publicly declaring their allegiance to the teachings of Jesus. Joseph takes Jesus' body to his own private family tomb, a brand new man-made cave carved out of the soft Jerusalem rock on a nearby hillside. The Jews believe that a criminal's presence in a tomb desecrates it. Even worse for a member of the Sanhedrin to touch a dead body on Passover makes him unclean and disqualifies him from eating the Seder. By law, Joseph and Nicodemus will be declared impure and must undergo a 7-day cleansing ritual. No matter, these two bold members of the Sanhedrin demonstrate their role as followers of Jesus by carrying his limp corpse down off Golgotha and then to the nearby tomb. There is no time to perform the ritual washing and anointing of the corpse with oil, but they do make the extravagant gesture of coating the body in expensive myrrh and aloe to overwhelm the coming smell of decomposition. Then they wrap the body tightly in linen, making sure to keep it loose around Jesus' face, in case he's not really dead, but merely unconscious. In this way, he will not suffocate. Jewish tradition dictates that all bodies be examined 3 days after apparent death. Thus the tomb will be reopened and Jesus will be observed on Sunday. But all this is merely adherence to ritual, for Jesus is clearly dead. The spear rupturing the pericardial sac around his heart left no doubt. Nonetheless, the tomb will be reopened on Sunday. When death is formally pronounced, his body will rest inside the tomb for a full year. Then the bones will be removed from his decomposed body and placed in a small stone jar, known as an ossuary, to be either stored in a niche carved into the tomb wall or removed to a new location. The tomb of Jesus is in a garden outside the city walls. The stone that will cover its entrance weighs hundreds of pounds. It's already in position, resting atop a track that makes it easier to roll. The track, however, is engineered to a slightly downhill angle. Sealing the tomb today will be much easier than rolling away the heavy stone on Sunday. Joseph and Nicodemus carry the body into the tomb and lay it down on a carved rock ledge. The air is dusty and laden with the smell of heavy perfume. The men say a formal goodbye to Jesus and then step outside the tomb. Mary, the mother of Jesus, watches as the two men strain to roll a stone across the tomb entrance. Mary Magdalene also looks on. The shaft of daylight penetrating the tomb grows smaller and smaller as the rock rolls into position. Jesus of Nazareth predicted his death and even prayed that God take the cup of sorrow from his lips. But now it is done. The silence of the grave is complete. Alone in the darkness of the tomb, Jesus of Nazareth finally rests in peace. Chapter 20, Pilate's Palace, Jerusalem, Saturday, April 8th, AD 30, daytime. Pontius Pilate has visitors. Once again, Caiaphas and the Pharisees stand before him. But now they are inside the palace, no longer fearful of being made unclean by the governor's presence, for Passover is done. For the first time, Pilate notices that Caiaphas is actually terrified of Jesus' power. What was not so obvious in the Nazarene's lifetime is now quite apparent in death, for the chief priest is making an unheard-of request. Caiaphas tells Pilate directly, "That deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples might come, steal a body, and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead.'" There is a certain logic to the request, for the disappearance of Jesus' body might lead to an uprising against the temple priests, as his followers convince people that this man who claims to be the Christ has actually proven himself to be immortal. The presence of a Roman guard will deter any attempt to break into the tomb to steal the corpse. Pilate consents to Caiaphas's request. "Take a guard," he orders, "make the tomb secure." And so it is that a Roman guard is placed at the tomb of Jesus, just in case the dead man tries to escape. That should have been the end of it. The troublemaker and the blasphemer is dead. The Sanhedrin in Rome no longer have any cause for concern. If the Nazarene's followers had any plans for trouble, there is no sign of it. The disciples have proven themselves timid, still stunned that their Messiah is dead. They have gone into hiding and pose no threat to Rome. Pilate is relieved. Soon he will be on his way back to Caesarea, there once again to govern without the constant interference of the temple priests. But Caiaphas will not go away. Wearing his expensive robes and linen, he postures before Pilate, not knowing how the Roman governor will report back to Rome. Caiaphas has much at stake and is uneasy over Pilate's hand-washing display, which makes it clear that the governor is trying to distance himself from the proceeding. He will lose everything if Emperor Tiberius blames him for the death of Jesus. So Caiaphas stands firm, looking for any sign of approval from Pilate. But the Roman governor has had quite enough of this arrogant priest. Without a word, he stands and walks away. Chapter 21, Jesus' Tomb, Sunday, April 9th, AD 30, Dawn. The morning is dark. Dawn will soon break over Jerusalem, making the third day since Jesus' death. Mary Magdalene now takes it upon herself to perform the traditional task of examining the dead body. She travels with another woman named Mary, though not the mother of Jesus. Just as on the day the Nazarene was executed, the streets of the upper city are quiet as the two women pass through. They exit the city at the Gannath Gate and now travel in the Nazarene's last footsteps as they walk toward Golgotha. The vertical pole on which Jesus was crucified still stands atop the hill, awaiting the next crucifixion. The two Marys look away from the gruesome image and walk around the hill to Jesus' tomb. They have practical matters on their minds. Mary Magdalene has never forgotten the many kindnesses Jesus showed her during his lifetime. And just as she once anointed him with perfume and washed his feet with her tears, she now plans to anoint the body with spices. It's unconscionable to her that Jesus' corpse might molder and emit a foul smell. Perhaps a year from now, when she returns for Passover and is among those who roll away the stone in front of Jesus' tomb to collect his bones, the smell of sweet perfume will pour forth from the cave entrance instead of the stench of death. But this presents another immediate challenge. Mary is physically incapable of rolling away the tombstone. She will require help. Yet most of Jesus' disciples are still in hiding. Since yesterday was the Sabbath and she followed the mandate to do nothing but rest, she does not know about the Roman soldier or to stand guard outside the tomb. But there is no guard. As the two Marys approach the tomb, they are stunned. The tombstone has been rolled away. The crypt is empty. Mary Magdalene cautiously steps forward and looks inside. She smells the myrrh and aloe in which Jesus' body was anointed. She clearly sees the linen shroud in which the body was wrapped. But there is nothing else there. And, to this day, the body of Jesus of Nazareth has never been found. Afterward. What comes next is the very root of the Christian faith. The Gospels record that Jesus' body was not stolen. Instead, Scripture puts forth that Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. After his body was found missing, the Gospels state that Jesus appeared 12 times on earth over a 40-day period. These apparitions range from a single individual to groups of more than 500 on a mountain in Galilee. Some in that large crowd would speak vividly of the event for years to come. A quarter century later, the disciple Paul included the mountain appearance in a letter to the Corinthians. Whether or not one believes that Jesus rose from the dead, the story of his life and message achieved much greater status after his crucifixion. He would go down in history not just as Jesus or Jesus of Nazareth, but as Jesus the Christ, the Messiah. Roman writers of the period reference his name, often preferring to call him Christus, the Latinized version of Christ. Unlike all other self-proclaimed messianic figures, Jesus became a noted personage in the history of Jerusalem and beyond. Theudas, the Egyptian prophet, and others such as Judas of Gamala, were almost instantly forgotten. Only Bar Kochba retained as much Jewish interest. Followers of Jesus within Judaism are attested to well beyond the first century. The elite did not welcome them, but archaeological evidence and outside sources show they persisted. The Roman historians Pliny the Younger, Cornelius Tacitus, and Suetonius all mention Jesus in their writings. The secular Greek-speaking historians Thallus and Phlegon, the satirist Lucian of Samosata, and the eminent Jewish historian Flavius Josephus also mention Jesus. Not all the writers were kind. Lucian, for example, mocks the early Christians for putting their faith in a man who died such a lowly death. Indeed, for centuries, Christians were embarrassed by the cross, for it was considered a punishment best suited for slaves, murderers, and members of the lowest class. Those opposed to the new Christian faith mocked believers for worshiping a criminal and his cross, and parodied Christianity as a form of madness. However, Christians began crossing themselves on the forehead and chest as a way of warding off demons. By the 4th century, the cross was more commonly viewed with pride, as a symbol that Jesus had suffered a lowly death for the benefit of all mankind. The crucifix, that iconic image showing the body of Jesus affixed to the cross, was not a part of Christian culture until 6 centuries after his death. The lack of representation of the cross may have been due to the church's belief in his resurrection. After the crucifixion, the disciples of Jesus underwent a radical shift in behavior. They were quite positive that they had seen a resurrected Jesus and soon went into the world and fearlessly preached his message. Known as the apostles, the men paid a tremendous price for their faith. In 44 AD, the grandson of Herod the Great, Herod Agrippa, who ruled Judea at the time, ordered that James, one of the sons of Thunder, be put to the sword. The beheading of James made him the first disciple to be martyred. Agrippa was violently opposed to Christianity and used his power to ruthlessly suppress the new theology of Jesus. For a time, he imprisoned Peter, but did not kill him. Peter's missionary work eventually took him to Rome, where he formalized the nascent Christian church. The Romans were not amused, sentencing Peter to death on the cross. When he protested that he was not worthy to die in the same manner as Jesus, the Romans agreed and nailed him to the cross upside down. The year is thought to be sometime around AD 64 to 67. There is good evidence that Peter is buried beneath St. Peter's Cathedral in Vatican City. The deaths of most of the disciples are consigned to legend. Andrew, the apostle known for being optimistic and enterprising, preached Jesus' message in what is now Ukraine, Russia, and Greece. He was finally believed to have been crucified in Patras, a Roman-controlled region of Greece. Legend says Andrew was bound to an X-shaped cross, thus giving rise to the St. Andrew's cross that adorns the national flag of Scotland to this day. The often pessimistic Thomas is thought to have been speared to death near Madras in India. Bartholomew preached in Egypt, Arabia, and what is now Iran, before being flayed, skinned alive, and then beheaded in India. Simon the Zealot was thought to have been sawed in half for his preaching in Persia. Philip evangelized in what is now Western Turkey. He is said to have been martyred by having hooks run through his ankles and then being hung upside down in the Greco-Roman city of Hierapolis. The gregarious former tax collector Matthew may have died in Ethiopia, murdered just like all the rest for his fervent preaching. Little is known about what happened to the others, except that each apostle spent his life preaching and was killed for doing so. It is a fact that the disciples of Jesus traveled as far as India, Britain, and even into Africa in their zeal to spread the faith, marking a vast sea change from their timid behavior during Jesus' life and in the hours after his death. The last to die was John, the other son of Thunder, who was taken prisoner by the Romans for preaching Christianity and exiled to the Greek island of Patmos. There he wrote his gospel, and also what would become the final pages of the New Testament, the Book of Revelation. John died in AD 100 in Ephesus, in what is now Turkey. He was 94 years old, and the only apostle not to have been martyred. Matthew's gospel in the first book of Acts attributes Judas Iscariot's death to suicide. Matthew writes that upon learning that his plan to force Jesus' hand had resulted in the execution order, Judas flung his 30 pieces of silver into the temple and hung himself from a tree. Legend has it that he used a horse's halter to break his own neck. Whether or not this is true, Judas Iscariot was never heard from again. The same is true for Mary Magdalene. After her appearance at the tomb of Jesus, she disappears from the story. She's very likely included among the women mentioned in Acts 1:14 as those empowered by the Spirit at Pentecost. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned in the book of Acts and alluded to in the book of Revelation as a woman clothed with the sun. But her fate goes unrecorded. On November 1, 1950, the Roman Catholic Church decreed that her body had been assumed into heaven. Pope Pius XII noted that Mary, having completed the course of her earthly life, was assumed body and soul into heavenly glory. 6 years after washing his hands of the Nazarene's execution, Pontius Pilate intervened in another case involving a Messiah, and this time it cost him his job. The preacher was a Samaritan who had holed up on a mountaintop sanctuary in Gerizim. Concerned by the man's growing legion of followers, Pilate suppressed the movement with heavily armed Roman soldiers. This resulted in many deaths and led Pilate to be recalled to Rome to explain his actions. He thought his appeal would be heard by his friend Emperor Tiberius. But by the time Pilate reached Rome, Tiberius was dead, done in either by disease or by being smothered, depending upon which Roman historian is telling the story. No matter, the 77-year-old debauched emperor was gone. The 4th-century historian Eusebius records that Pilate was later forced to commit suicide, becoming his own murderer and executioner. Where and how Pilate died is still debated. One report says he drowned himself in the Rhone River near Vienne, a city in modern-day France. There, a Roman monument still stands in the heart of the city and is often referred to as Pilate's tomb. Another report says Pilate hurled himself into a lake near Lausanne, in what is now Switzerland, where Mount Pilatus is said to have been named in his honor. There is also a rumor that Pilate and his wife Claudia converted to Christianity and were killed for their faith. Whether or not that's true, both the Coptic and Ethiopic Christian churches venerate Pilate as a martyr. Tiberius was replaced by Caligula, the 24-year-old son of Tiberius's deceased adopted child, Germanicus. Caligula promptly squandered almost all the fortune he inherited from Tiberius, a fortune partially earned on the backs of Galilean peasants. He served for only 4 years before being stabbed to death in an assassination eerily similar to that of the great Julius Caesar. He was succeeded in turn by the emperors Claudius and Nero, who continued the ruinous policies that eventually led to the downfall of Rome. This occurred 400 years later, in 476, when the Roman Empire was toppled by Germanic tribes. However, long before the empire's collapse, Rome turned away from its pagan gods and began worshiping Jesus Christ. Christianity was officially legalized throughout the Roman Empire in 313 with the Edict of Milan. With Pilate gone, Caiaphas was left without a Roman political ally. He had many enemies in Jerusalem and was soon replaced as the temple high priest. Caiaphas then left the stage and disappeared into history. The dates of his birth and death are unrecorded. But in 1990, an ossuary containing his bones was discovered in Jerusalem. They are currently on display at the Israel Museum. Herod Antipas may have been well-schooled in palace intrigue, but it eventually brought about his demise. His nephew, Agrippa, was known to be a close friend of the Roman emperor, Caligula. The Jewish historian Josephus relates that when Antipas foolishly asked Caligula to name him king instead of tetrarch, at the suggestion of his wife Herodias, who continued to get him into trouble, it was Agrippa who lodged charges that Antipas was plotting to execute Caligula. As proof, Agrippa pointed to the enormous arsenal of weaponry possessed by Antipas's army. So it was that Caligula ordered Antipas to spend the rest of his life exiled to Gaul. His fortune and territories were handed over to the younger Agrippa. The former tetrarch was joined in what is now France by Herodias. The two lived in Lugdunum, which many believe to be the location of modern-day Lyon. The tension between Rome and the Jewish people did not abate after the unjust crucifixion of Jesus. In AD 66, the Jews waged war on the Roman occupying army and took control of Jerusalem. Taxation was a key component of the struggle. However, the Romans did not accept defeat. By AD 70, they had surrounded the city with four Roman legions and were laying siege. Pilgrims arriving to celebrate Passover were allowed into the city, then not allowed to leave, which put considerable pressure on Jerusalem's limited water and food supplies. Somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million men, women, and children were stuck inside the city walls. Those attempting to escape were promptly crucified, and their crosses left on the surrounding heights for the residents of Jerusalem to witness the fate that awaited them. Thousands were eventually nailed to the cross during the siege, so many that the Romans ran out of wood. Trees had to be logged and carried to Jerusalem from miles away in order to accommodate the tremendous amount of crucifixions. Some of those who tried to flee were not crucified, but were instead sliced open so that Roman soldiers could scour their digestive tracts, because it was thought that many of Jerusalem's residents had swallowed their gold before trying to make their escape. When the Romans finally breached the city walls, the destruction was total. Those Jews who didn't escape were put to the sword or enslaved. The temple itself was burned to the ground, and much of the city was leveled. To this day, it has never been rebuilt. Recent excavations have dug down through the rubble to locate some of the actual streets and homes of Jesus' time, allowing visitors to walk in his footsteps and examine what life was like in Jerusalem. Of note is that the Via Dolorosa, wasn't established until centuries later, and was not in existence during Jesus' lifetime. A footnote, the Via Dolorosa is still cited by tour companies and souvenir sellers as the road to the crucifixion site. The real path that Jesus walked began at Herod's palace, near what is now the Jaffa Gate. It ends at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is thought to have been built atop the site of Golgotha and near Jesus' tomb. Today, visitors can not only tour these sites, but also touch the place where the cross of Jesus is said to have rested. In AD 132, with the city of Jerusalem still not completely rebuilt, there was a second uprising against the Romans known as Bar Kochba. The Emperor Hadrian had originally been sympathetic to the Jews, allowing them to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. But he soon changed his mind, preferring to reinvent the temple as a splendid pagan complex dedicated to himself and the Roman god Jupiter. Hadrian not only banned the Jews from rebuilding, but also began deporting them to Egypt and North Africa. The Jewish rebellion grew to such proportions that Judea became a main focus of the Roman army's war efforts, with complete legions sent to suppress the revolt. Not only were almost 600,000 Jews slaughtered and almost 1,000 villages leveled by its end, but worship practices such as reading the Torah, performing circumcisions, and observing Sabbath were outlawed. For the next several centuries, the Jews of Judea were routinely persecuted, even as the Roman Emperor embraced Christianity, starting in the 4th century. In AD 637, Muslim forces defeated the Byzantine and predominantly Christian army that occupied Jerusalem. The Muslims later built a mosque on the site of the former Jewish temple. As long as it remains there, Jewish hopes for rebuilding the temple on the original site will remain unrealized. The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the nearby shrine known as the Dome of the Rock have stood since 705 and 691, respectively. After its destruction by the Romans, Jerusalem became a rundown city. But over the centuries, the Jews have returned, despite several attempts to drive them out. As recently as 1948, the Jordanian army flushed every Jew from the old city, killing all those who would not leave. Finally, at the conclusion of the Six-Day War on June 10, 1967, more than 2,000 years after its destruction by the Romans, all of Jerusalem was once again in Jewish hands. It is interesting to note that in many parables, Jesus of Nazareth predicted harsh things for the city of Jerusalem. There is no question, those things came true. Postscript. Both Martin Dugard and I learned a tremendous amount while researching and writing this book. But one intriguing question and a profound statement of fact stand out. First, the question. Why did thousands of common people seek out Jesus of Nazareth? Most couldn't even hear him preach, as the vast crowds that surrounded Jesus were too thick for personal interaction. So why did they come? What was Jesus doing that prompted so many people to set aside their daily labor to be near him? Christians attribute Jesus' popularity to his message of love, hope, and truth, but also to his miraculous healings. But even non-believers must admit that something extraordinary was happening in Galilee. Second, there is no doubt that Jesus of Nazareth is the most famous human being the world has ever known. But Jesus had no infrastructure. He had no government behind him. He had no corporation. He and his disciples depended upon the charity of others for food and shelter. And Jesus had no organization other than a dozen faithful followers. In the history of mankind, no one has achieved worldwide fame with no outside resources whatsoever. Since his death, Jesus has played a continual role throughout history. The legalization of Christianity by the Roman Empire in AD 313 soon led to its expansion into every part of the Western world. Not until the Prophet Muhammad began the Islamic religion in 610 did Christianity have any meaningful competition in terms of numbers of followers. Muhammad considered Jesus a prophet and is quoted in the Quran as saying, "When Jesus came with clear signs, he said, 'Now I have come to you with wisdom, and in order to make clear to you some of the points on which you dispute. Therefore, fear God and obey me.'" In the United States, George Washington used Christianity as a rallying point for his colonial army, saying in his first general order to his troops, "Every officer and man will endeavor to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier, defending the dearest rights and liberties of his country." Abraham Lincoln also referred to Jesus in a wartime setting. "When I went to Gettysburg and looked upon the graves of our dead heroes who had fallen in defense of their country, I then and there consecrated myself to Christ." Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, based his entire ministry and civil rights struggle on the teachings of Jesus. Also, his nonviolent philosophy was adapted in part from the ordeal Jesus experienced. About enemies, Dr. King said the following, "Just keep loving them, and by the power of your love, they will break down under the load." That's love, you see. It is redemptive, and this is why Jesus says love. There's something about love that builds up and is creative. There is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So love your enemies. President Ronald Reagan picked up on that theme. He promised there will never be a dark night that does not end. And by dying for us, Jesus showed how far our love should be ready to go all the way. In the wake of writing Killing Lincoln and Killing Kennedy, Martin Dugard and I were excited to take on this project. But putting together Killing Jesus was exceedingly difficult. We had to separate fact from myth based upon a variety of sources, some of which had their own agendas. But I believe we have brought you an accurate account of not only how Jesus died, but also the way he lived and how his message has affected the entire world. Thanks again for listening. This is Bill O'Reilly. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Killing Jesus, A History. Killing Jesus was directed by Scott Sherritt and Laura Wilson. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2013 by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Production copyright 2013 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.